don't know how in the world I live up to that. Good morning. And thank you very much, Rabbi Kelemer. As someone who attended YU in the early 90s and then did smicha at YU's Reitz in the mid-90s, and grew up in Oceanside. So Rabbi Kelemer was really a role model for us as young rabbis, as someone who is both a Talmud Chacham and beloved in the community, and someone who can manage both sides of the Rabbanus, both as a posek and as a Mara D'Asra for everybody. I was honored to be able to give a shiur in which you'd be present, and now that you gave that introduction, I don't know what to do. But nonetheless, thank you very much. I also want to make sure to thank Jonathan Altmark for his help in setting up the shiur this morning. And also, of course, Moshe Mazel Tov on your bar mitzvah this morning. When Jonathan and I first traded emails, so he talked about what would be a potential topic for the shiur this morning, I think I first sent in a couple of topics. One was the arc of Nebuchadnezzar's rise and fall in Sefer Daniel. Another one was the translation of the Torah into Greek, which we mentioned in the Slichos this morning. But then I made the mistake of throwing in a third topic, which I hadn't given a shiur on in the past. And lo and behold, that's the one that was the winner topic. So I actually benefited by having the opportunity to really prepare this for the shiur this morning. Our topic is Birchas Kohanim, Duchening on a fast day, and Halachic change. And we'll get into both halves of that. The issue of Birchas Kohanim at Mincha on a fast day, which is relevant, of course, since today is Asara B'Teves. But also, the second half of that, the issue of halachic change and where and why halacha is conservative. That topic also is relevant for today, since, as we mentioned, the 9th of Teves, we mentioned in the Slichos, is the passing of Ezra HaSofer, who's responsible for our Masorah. He's responsible for much of the way Judaism looks today. And so both halves of that are relevant for this time of year. We begin, the sheets are around, people have them. We begin with the Gemara in Tanis, which tells us about the practice of Birchas Kohanim at Mincha on a fast day. Begins with a Mishnah. B'shlosha prakim bashana, Kohanim nosin es kapein arba pa'amim b'yom. Three times in the course of the year, or really three types of days in the course of the year, Kohanim will duchen. I use the colloquial duchen rather than raise their hands, but you understand we're talking about Birchas Kohanim, Nesias Kapayim. Kohanim duchen four times in the course of the day. Shachris, Musaf, Mincha, and Ne'ilas Sha'arim, what we call Ne'ila. When are these three times of the year? Taniyos, fast days. Ma'amados. The ma'amad is, make a long story short, a way in which Yisraelim, those of us who are neither Kohanim nor Levim, can be represented on the karbanos that are brought every day in our name in the Beis HaMikdash. You had shifts of Yisraelim who would be the representatives of Yisraelim as a whole. They had a special Kriya Satara, they would have special fasts, they would gather together. That's the Ma'amad. So apparently you had Birchas Kohanim for them, according to this Mishnah, four times a day during their week of being the Ma'amad, as well as Yom HaKippurim, Yom Kippur. That's the Mishnah's statement. So the Gemara wants to know, who is the author of this Mishnah? Because in fact, this is subject to debate. Not everybody agrees that you should have Duchening four times a day on these particular days of the year. Rav Nachman, Rabba Baravua, Zutiva Rabbi Meir. Rav Nachman quotes Rabba Baravua to say that Mishnah that says you would duchen four times a day on a fast day, that Mishnah is the view of Rabbi Meir. Aval Chachamim Omrim, Shachris Umusav Yeshba Nesias Kapayim, Mincho Ne'ila Einba Nesias Kapayim. The Chachamim disagree and they say that we duchen at Shachris, we duchen at Musaf on these days, but not Mincha and Ne'ila. Mincha and Ne'ila, you would not duchen. Man Chacham, so whose view is the view of the Chachamim? By the way, we know, of course, that you don't have, the Gemara separately notes, you don't have Musaf on fast days, right? You have Musaf on Yom Kippur. It doesn't mean that on all of these days you will end up duchening four times. It means that every time you daven, you will duchen. So a day like today, when we don't have Musaf, you obviously won't have a Musaf Birchas Kohanim, a Musaf Nesias Kapayim. But the point is, Rabbi Meir is of the position that every time you daven, you're going to duchen, whereas the view of the Chachamim, which we're going to say is the view of Rabbi Yehuda, is that you're only going to duchen in the morning. You're going to duchen at Shachris, you're going to duchen at Musaf if there's a Musaf, let's say Yom Kippur. You will not duchen at Mincha and Ne'ilah. And the Gemara walks us through it. Man Chachamim, who is this position of the Chachamim who say you duchen in the morning but not in the afternoon and evening? Rabbi Yehuda, it's the position of Rabbi Yehuda, Tisanya, as a Braisa teaches us. Shachris u'musaf mincho ne'ilah kulan yesh bahen nesias kapayim divrei Rabbi Meir. The position of Rabbi Meir is, every time you daven on a fast day, you're going to duchen. Shachris, musaf, mincha, ne'ilah, the whole string. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Shachris and Musaf Yesh Ben Nesias Kapayim. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, only the morning ones. Shachris and Musaf. Mincha Ne'ilah, Ein Ben Nesias Kapayim. Mincha Ne'ilah, no duchening. And then you get the third position, the position of Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ne'ilah Yesh Ben Nesias Kapayim. Mincha Ein Ben Nesias Kapayim. Rabbi Yossi deals with these afternoon tefilos, and Rabbi Yossi's position is that we would duchen at Ne'ilah. We would not duchen at mincha. So we have three different positions articulated here. Rabbi Meir saying duchen every tefillah. Rabbi Yehuda saying only in the morning. And Rabbi Yossi not discussing the morning. Let's assume he says duchen in the morning. But duchen in the morning, duchen at ne'ilah, not at mincha. He takes out mincha. So the Gemara asks, but my kamifli, what's this debate about? Why do I have three different views? So Rabbi Meir, the Gemara says, Rabbi Meir savar kol yom atayma maylo parsi kana yadayu b'mincha. So Rabbi Meir says, look, why don't we have the kohenim duchen at mincha on a daily basis? Yesterday at mincha, we didn't have the kohenim duchen. Why didn't we have the kohenim duchen at mincha? Mishum shechrus. Because of concern for intoxication, like the avodos in the Beis HaMikdash, like the service in the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohen is not allowed to perform Birchas Kohenim while intoxicated. We have a relatively low threshold for what qualifies as intoxicated. And there's a concern that on your average afternoon, the Kohen might be in this state. And therefore, since we don't want him to get up and duchen in this inebriated state, therefore we say no duchening at mincha. So Rabbi Meir says, ha'ino leka shichrus. He says, on a fast day, presumably, hopefully, the Kohen is going to get up to duchen, isn't drunk. And therefore, let him duchen all the tefillos, let him duchen every time. Rabbi Meir's position is, I am not concerned for intoxication on fast days. Okay, so why does Rabbi Yehuda say not to duchen at mincha and ne'ilah? The next line, Rabbi Yehuda, Savar shachris u'musaf t'chol yom alo shchiach shechris lo gazir b'hu rabbanan. Rabbi Yehuda says, you duchen shachris and musaf every day. There's no concern for intoxication, so do it on the fast day as well. There's no reason why you should stop on a fast day. But mincha ne'ilah d'chol yom ashricha shichrus gazri b'hu rabbanan. But in the afternoon, there's always a concern for inebriation. Not on a fast day, true. But if you tell people that they can duchen on a fast day, then in the afternoon, then they're going to think you can duchen also during the week on a fast day. Who is it that we're worried about is going to show up in shul on a fast day, see the kohenim duchen, and then think, therefore they're supposed to duchen on some other day? I'm not sure. In other words, what's the practical element here? The person who actually, his first day in shul is going to be Asar B'Tevis. He's going to see the kohen duchen at mincha, and he himself is a kohen, let's say. He gets up and he duchens. He's going to march up to the bima the following day and think that he's supposed to duchen at mincha? That's the idea behind the gezeira. That's the idea behind the decree, although I have to confess that it's hard to imagine this happening in practice. Nonetheless, Rabbi Yehuda says, don't duchen in the afternoon of fast days, lest there be confusion from the fast day to a normal day. That's Rabbi Yehuda's position. And then we get Rabbi Yossi. And Rabbi Yossi said, do it for Ne'ilah, don't do it for Mincha. What's Rabbi Yossi's rationale? Rabbi Yossi sabar Mincha de'isa b'chol yom gazu b'hu rabbanan. Ne'ilah de'lesa b'chol yom ala gazu b'hu rabbanan. Rabbi Yossi says, look, you have a mincha every day. So therefore, there could be confusion from the mincha of the fast day to the mincha that occurs during the week. That I get. But you don't have ne'ilah on non-fast days. There's a separate discussion about which fast days get ne'ilah. That's beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss. But you're not going to have a ne'ilah on a regular day. So therefore, there's no gezeira. He says, the only tefillah, the only prayer of a fast day at which we will not dochen, will be mincha, because mincha exists during the week. So the Gemara here, I skipped a little piece, the Gemara talks about which position we follow, and various Amoraim say we should follow Rabbi Meir, but then along comes Rav Nachman, and he says, actually, we don't. Rav Nachman Amar halacha k'Rabbi Yosi, v'halacha k'Rabbi Yosi. Rav Nachman says we follow Rabbi Yosi, which is to say, we will duchen Shachris, we will duchen Musaf, we will duchen Ne'ilah, we will not duchen at Mincha because of concern for confusion with the rest of the year when it's not a fast day. So the Gemara says, that's interesting. The law follows Rabbi Yosi, we don't duchen at Mincha. If you're telling me we follow Rabbi Yosi and you should not be duchening at Mincha, why do we? The Gemara asks. In the days of the Gemara, someone is duchening. Kohanim are duchening at Mincha on a fast day. Why are we doing that? And so they answer, Kevin de Vesamuch Lishkias Hachama Kaparsi, Ketfilas Ne'ila Damya. Since we daven Mincha close to sunset, therefore, it's like Ne'ila. So in other words, the reason why the Chachamim said, don't duchen at Mincha, is because it's going to fool people into thinking duchen et mincha during the week. However, we daven mincha late on a fast day, we daven mincha close to sunset, and therefore you won't get confused with what happens during the week. It's going to look like ne'ila. Now, what does that tell us about the way they daven mincha normally? They daven early, correct. They would daven mincha normally early in the day. Since we are davening mincha late, specifically on a fast day, therefore there will be no confusion. People will look at it as being like ne'ilah. Now there's a little bit of discussion in halacha. As a matter of practice, the Rambam rules in Hilchos Tefillah Perek Yadalad, the Shulchan Aruch brings it in Aruch Chaim Kuf Chav Tes, that we follow this view. This is indeed the psak. There's a discussion about mincha on a day when there is ne'ilah, mincha on a day when there's no ne'ilah, but I'm not going to go into that. I did bring you a link in source number 2. There's a fine collection of opinions that are cited in the article at source number 2, which discuss how early mincha can be and still qualify as close to dark, tying it into Plaga Mincha, but it's beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. But all of this leads to a key question for us. You're telling me that we follow the view of Rabbi Yosi, and therefore we shouldn't duchen at Mincha, unless Mincha is late, and therefore different from the normal way that we daven Mincha. Well, what if we don't? What if on a fast day we daven Mincha Gedola? Right? There's a Mincha Gedola here today, I heard announced, right? So what about, what do you do then? Now, we don't duchen here, I think, but will the Chazan say, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu? Will he do that at Mincha, Gedola? Svardim do. What does the Shul do? You do. You do say it. So you're saying that you duchen, even though you're davening early. Right? Against the position that was articulated here in the Gemara. What about the following question? Most shuls have a shkia mincha marav, right? Yidavin mincha. Sunset occurs sometime during Chazaras Hashatz or immediately thereafter. And then marav, right? So yidavin mincha late every day. Not late, but you're davening mincha at sunset every day. And you're davening mincha at sunset on a fast day. So therefore there's no distinction between what you're doing during the year and what you're doing on the fast day. So should you still duchen at a fast day when you're davening close to sunset? Or should you say the logic brought in the Gemara no longer applies? If you take a look at source number 3, Rav Moshe Sternbach explains why they used to daven mincha late on a fast day specifically. Normally they prefer to daven mincha earlier, because generally speaking, the Gemara is of the view that you should daven as soon as you can. There's a little bit of discussion regarding mincha, v'yiruuchem shemesh, you should daven at the time of sunset perhaps, but Rav Sternbach explains that they had a specific reason to daven late on a fast day. He says, yisod ha'tam shekol yom ispalu mincha gedolo b'yom tzom samoch la'erev, hu di'alfinim betanez yod beiz mikroi shemachatzi ha'tzahara. He says the reason why they davened late on a fast day, whereas normally they davened an early mincha, is because they deduce in the Gemara and Tanis Daf Yubeis, they draw it from Psukim, that the practice on fast days was to read Tanakh in the afternoon of the fast, and then get to Mincha at the end of the day. So they were learning all afternoon. This was done for Musar purposes. They would do this, and then they would daven relatively late. So that's what they normally did. But the Chazon Ish says, what about us? If you take a look at source number 4, the Hebrew is on the bottom of the first side, the English is at the top of the second side. Yesh la'ayin. The Chazon Ish says, we have to examine what we ought to do. Kishanan nehigin lehispala mincha samach l'shkiyas hachama b'chol yom v'leka l'didan hekera. He says, we daven mincha close to sunset every day, and therefore no one will be able to tell the difference between mincha on a fast day and mincha on a daily basis. So, or he says, should we duchen at mincha on a fast day? Maybe we don't draw a distinction. Or alternatively, we daven early. We daven mincha gedola dafka on a fast day. So then, what ought we do? That's the Chazon Ish's question. What he's asking fundamentally, and this is a major question with ramifications all through areas of halakha, is, do I honor the Gemara's practice, or do I honor the Gemara's logic? Right? The logic of the Gemara says, you only duchen at mincha on a fast day if it's at a time that you don't daven mincha during the week, earlier or later, but something that's not when you normally daven mincha during the week. So I could follow the logic and say, well, open up your luach and see. On the other hand, you could say, no, honor the practice of the Gemara. At the conclusion of the sealing of the Talmud, Chasimas HaTalmud is the expression that the Chazon Ish and the Kilas Yaakov will use. They said to duchen at mincha on a fast day, therefore we will duchen at mincha on a fast day, and I don't care whether the logic applies or not. This is not just a question of Birchas Kohanim. Can you think of other cases among our normal everyday practices that fit or that should raise the same question? Yeah. Good.
In the old days, people used to have meals in the shul on Friday night. Most part, they don't anymore.
Excellent. Kiddush and Shul Friday nights. Kiddush used to be because guests would show up and you'd need to make Kiddush for them. Now, I don't know when the last time was that somebody ate a dinner in Shul Friday night, that somebody just stopped in and sat down with his food. It may happen on occasion. But that we have this practice, which outside of Eretz Yisrael is very common, is very strange. We're going to actually discuss that. Yeah. Right.
Most shuls probably wouldn't do that.
Right, although there it's not an issue of whether we're following the practice or logic of the Gemara. There's a question of, are we counting them, period? Right. Whether that fits into the Gemara. Tosfos has a discussion about counting the child. Right, but is that a function of right, but I would ask the question of, is that a case of the Gemara dictating one thing and then our practice either mimicking their practice when their logic doesn't apply, or mimicking their logic and therefore changing their practice? Sorry?
Medicines on Shabbos.
Medicines on Shabbos. Why would that be?
Oh,
so you're, right. So what you're talking about is sort of the sister case of this one, right? The case of keeping to a practice when the reason that we understand for it no longer applies, right? As opposed to the case of changing the practice in order to suit the logic, so dropping the practice in order to, because the logic no longer pertains, the question of grinding up medication. Whether the logic still exists or not is an interesting discussion. The Tzitz Eliezer has a long piece about this and about homeopathic medicine and how people are still grinding up medicines. It's a fascinating discussion in its own right. So what do we do? Well, the Chazon Ish discusses this and leaves it as a tzarech iyun. He says, you know, this requires examination. However, Rav Chaim Kanievsky spilled the beans. Rav Yaakov Kanievsky, actually, spilled the beans. And his Kilas Yaakov, the stipler, told us what the Chazon Ish actually did. He said that in the Beis Medrash of the Chazon Ish, they duchened. Even though the logic of the Gemara no longer applied, he said, keep doing what they were doing in the time of the Gemara. So they duchened at Minchan Birchas Kohanim. We will continue to duchen because, he said, we don't want to miss the mitzvah of Birchas Kohanim. Now, the question arises, what mitzvah is this? What is the mitzvah of Birchas Kohanim? Do they indeed have an obligation to duchen? How often each day do they have an obligation? What if nobody calls them to duchen? And so on. That's a question in its own right. But that was the position of the Chazon Ish. Even though the logic didn't apply, and Rav Yaakov Kanievsky in his Kilas Yaakov tries to explain why. You were going to say?
It seems that it's a little bit inconsistent. If you're going to already let Duchen because they did it at the time of the Gemara like that, so why not have a Mincha later also?
Maybe you want to just switch your Mincha?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. Right. Well, he would argue that there was no takana for them to daven mincha late. There was a takana of duchening. There was no takana of davening mincha late. But it's an interesting point in the sense that he didn't say, I want to satisfy the way the Gemara did it, so I'm going to move my mincha time, and then I'll have no problem. You could have made that argument. He didn't do that. That's a good point. Take a look at source number 5, please, where the stipler lays out the two options. He says, Efshar, it could be, it could be that because of the time that the Gemara was sealed, and he's quoting the Chazon Ish in this first half, he says, it could be that since when the Gemara was sealed, Parsi Yadai B'mincha D'Tahanisa, they duchened at Mincha, we don't change their practice. Even if we daven Mincha early, we do what they did. That's one approach. But then he brings a second approach on his own. The Chazon Ish didn't say, Yesh Lomar, you could say, Sha'aba pisha tam shaharu lasas nesias kapaya b'mincha d'taniso humishum d'parsi samoch l'shkiyas hachama. You could say that even though the reason for duchening at mincha on a fast day is because they're doing it close to sunset and therefore it doesn't look like what happens during the week, mikol makom kishaharu lisa kapaya b'mincha lo asu t'nai. Maybe when they said, we're going to duchen at mincha, they didn't state any such condition. The Gemara gave us an explanation of, you won't get confused with mincha during the week because they're at different times. However, that doesn't mean that they said that in the original enactment. The original takana was without that. The original takana was stated without a condition. The Gemara is just offering us a logical explanation. And that's a second way that you could look at it. And he gives us examples of other cases in which a takana, an enactment, is created without any conditions. And he says, you know what? He says, when the Chachamim got together, whichever Beis Din it was, whichever group it was, that concluded this should be the law, when they said it's the law, they figured, if circumstances change at some point in time, there will be a Beis Din that will properly change our practice in order to suit it. They did not foresee a time when we would not be able to modify things. They did not foresee a time when something would become frozen in stone, and frozen in ice, turned to stone, and we would not be able to adjust it. And the stipler brings a whole set of examples. If you take a look at source number 6, I brought you one of them. Tani, this is from the Yerushalmi in Trumos, as you see in source number 6. Bas Yisrael shenichnasa lahadlik mikohenes. Let's say you have a Yisraelis who goes into the house of Kohanim. And she's there for a variety of purposes. The commentators on the Yerushalmi there note she may be there to serve, she may be there for some purpose to help them. But in any case, she wants to light her lamp. But the oil that they're using there is what's called Shemen Sreifa, which is Truma oil that has become Tameh. And it's really meant for use by Kohanim. Nonetheless, Toveles Psila Shemen Sreifa Umadlekes. She is allowed to dip the wick for her lamp in their Truma oil and light it. Why? Rav Chuna b'shem Dvei Rabbi Yannai said, Sha'as Mishlachas Ze'evim Haisa. It was a time when there were wolves around, and it was dangerous to walk around without a lamp at night. And And therefore, in order to preserve safety, they said, okay, we're going to let you have this lamp, even though you're using truma oil, which rabbinically they shouldn't have been able to do. We're going to override the rabbinic prohibition. However, as the Yerushalmi concludes, v'lo amad beis din ubitel, no beis din ever changed it. The practice continued. Even when there were no wolves anymore, nonetheless, they kept right on going, saying, all us Yisraelim, we could light our lamps using tamei truma oil, just like the Kohanim could, in violation of an apparent rabbinic law. So he brings that as an example. He also brings some more popular examples. V'sein talumatar, right? Why do we start, outside of Eretz Yisrael, we start saying V'sein talumatar December 3rd, 4th, 5th? What's the association? 6 days after the Tekufah, but why 60 days after the Tekufah? Where did we get this idea from? In Eretz Yisrael, they're doing it from the 7th of Cheshvan. Why are we saying the same Talu Matar starting in December? Because that was the Luach in Bavel. That's when they need rain in Iraq. So therefore, we're going to daven for Iraq to have rain. That's not my chiddush. That's the way it is. So the Rosh gets up, right, about 700 years ago, and says, what in the world are we doing? We don't live in Iraq. Why shouldn't we change it? Either follow Eretz Yisrael or follow when you need rain. But what are you doing with Iraqi rain? What's the idea there? And the Rush actually tries to change it. And there's a whole fight that goes on. It involves Chol Hamoed Pesach and a letter written on Chol Hamoed Pesach. There's a whole story which you may have heard about this. But the Rush says you should change it. Because he says it's inappropriate. V'sein talu matar was supposed to match Eretz Yisrael or where you live. And the point that the Hillel Yaakov makes in quoting the Rush is he says, you know, the Rush only disagrees because of the Gemara's language regarding v'sein talu matar. However, the Rush agrees with the fundamental principle that once a practice is set in the Gemara, that's what's going to continue even when the logic doesn't hold. He brings more cases. I'm not going to mention every case that he brings. But to mention one of them, which is brought in a footnote in the Stipler, in the Kilas Yaakov, blowing shofar at Musaf. We normally have a mitzvah. We normally have a rule, excuse me, of zrizin makdim le mitzvah. So you have a mitzvah to do, you should do it as early as possible. So why do we wait for Musaf to blow shofar? You ever have the burn down mosque? They tell you on the bottom of the page. Sorry? Not about the satan. That was a different kind of a satan. Not to wait for everybody to be there. They would be there at Shacharis if we told them to. Maybe. It was the time of the Romans, and it was dangerous. The Burma Mamsa gives you a little note at the bottom of the page. That there was a concern that if you blew shofar in the morning, the Romans thought this was a sign of revolt. And therefore they moved it to Musaf. Ah, but we haven't been living under Romans for what, 1600 years? Nonetheless, we still do it. Ditto for including Shema in Kedusha of Musaf. Right? That's how Shema ends up in Kedusha of Musaf. Because apparently, we were under threat if we were caught saying Shema. But the people who were watching left. They went out for Kiddush after Shacharis. And therefore, we could get away with it by including it in Kedusha at Musaf. So all sorts of practices persist. Even though the reason no longer applies. I brought you in source number 7, the Prichadash on the side of the page in Shulchan Aruch discusses the law of Gilui, right? Not using wine that's been left uncovered, concern for snakes having drunk from the wine. There are many other cases, but in the interests of time and moving on to other points, the basic rule that Kilas Yaakov suggests is, in fact, that the practice does not change, even when the logic is no longer relevant. And he brings us the Kiddush in Shul case. If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Yosef Karo, Beis Yosef, who discusses this topic, he says, Haran Sham, regarding Kiddush in Shul Friday night, he says, Haran Sham kiyem haminog, mishum dekeven de meikara iskin mishum orchin, amrino leishat hakanos chachamim kevuos hein. He says, yes, initially Kiddush was instituted Friday night in Shul because of guests, But once it was instituted, it remains. And he says, I'll tell you, the same thing is true regarding May and Sheva. Right? Magen Avos, after Marav and Shul Friday, after the Marav Shemoneh Esrei. When we do Magen Avos, that's there because of people who were out in the fields and who would be walking home late, and we wanted them to be able to catch up with everybody else. And so for the sake of their safety, we said, let's stall. By adding in this sort of pseudo-Chazaras Hashatz at Marav. It doesn't really belong, but we'll do it anyway. Ah, but we don't have people coming in from the fields anymore. Nonetheless, the practice remains. So writes the Beis Yosef. He also mentions the Rambam on Chazaras Hashatz, that we repeat the Shemoneh Esrei even if there's no one there who needs a repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei, because everybody's expert, not to mention we have printed Siddurim, and therefore they're able to say it themselves. Nonetheless, practices persist. So writes the Beis Yosef. So the conclusion of the Stipler is that we will continue to duchen. He supports the practice of the Chazon Ish. We will continue to duchen at Mincha on a fast day against the logic of the Gemara, which really dictates that, based on the way we daven Mincha, we should not. We daven Mincha the same time every day. We daven the same time on a fast day. No, or we're davening Mincha early, and the Gemara was talking about late Mincha. Nonetheless, we're going to continue the practice. And so the question is, why? Why should I honor the practice of the Gemara over the logic of the Gemara? Can we get some insight into how and why this works? And I believe we can by looking at a related issue. The related issue is, why don't Amoraim in the Gemara, the sages of the Gemara, why don't they argue with Tanaim, the sages of the Mishnah? This is a discussion which has four different approaches. I have to credit an article from Yeshiva, I think it's called Birchas Moshe in Israel, and I believe the article was written by Rav Chaim Sabato, but he didn't sign his name to it, so I'm not 100% sure. But I believe this was his piece where he collected the ingredients for what I'm about to say on this issue of Amoraim disagreeing with Tanaim. What do you think the reason is why an Amora will not disagree with a Tana, other than Rav, who is an exception to the rule? But generally speaking, an Amora will not disagree with a Tana. Why is that? They knew better. So that's the assumption we make walking in, is that they in fact knew more than we do. And we're going to get to that. That's one answer out of four that we're actually going to see. But it's not at all clear-cut. Rav Yosef Karo, in his Kesef Mishnah, comments on the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim. The Rambam, in his second chapter in Hilchos Mamrim, talks about the idea of changing rabbinic decrees, changing gezeros, or disagreeing with a drasha that an earlier generation had, a lesson that they learned from a pasuk. Take a look at source number 9. He writes, Hadisnan parakamad de edios shein bezin yacholavat al divrei bezin chavero ad shei galo imenu b'chachma uv'minyan. He says, we have a Mishnah in the volume called Edyos, which says that no court is allowed to override, is capable of overriding the position of an earlier rabbinical court, an earlier Beis Din, unless it is greater in wisdom and in number. When we say number, what we mean is number of followers. Not online followers, but number of Chachamim who agree with the position of that Beis Din. So he says that position, that idea, Moki la Rabbeinu b'sha'oso yachid va'oso rabam nechliku b'gzera otakana. He says that is, according to the Rambam, is only if you're talking about where the earlier Beis Din made a decree, made an enactment, the later one is not allowed to disagree. But if the disagreement is different, one of them says, I have a gzera shava. And the other one says, well, we don't have this gzera shava. The latter Beis Din is allowed to disagree, is allowed to dispute the earlier one's position, even though they're not the equal of the earlier Beis Din. That's what he says. You're allowed to disagree with an earlier sage. Vim Tomar, and he says, if you'll then ask, Imkein Amailo Pligi Amoraya Tanoi, then why don't Amoraim disagree with Tanoim? And we know they don't. Because in the Gemara, very often, you'll find an Amora take a position, and the Gemara will say, well, how could he say that? So-and-so, the Tana, said something else. And he's forced to capitulate. So why don't they disagree? If you're telling me that there could be a later generation that will disagree with an earlier generation on, let's say, a Gezerah Shava, they'll say, I don't have such a tradition. I don't have your idea. So he writes, According to the Rambam, it would seem an Amora could disagree with a Tana. You could say, Shemiyom Chasimas HaMishnah Kimu V'Kiblu Shadoros HaAchronim Lo Yachloku Al HaRishonim. He says, you know why? Tradition. Since the earliest time, since when the Mishnah was closed, they accepted that later generations would not disagree with earlier generations. V'chein Asu Gam B'Chasimas HaGemara Shemiyom Shenichtem Alonitan Rishus L'Shem Adam Lachloku Le'ah. And so they did when the Gemara was concluded, that they simply decided you can't disagree with the earlier generation. Why? Doesn't say. That's simply the conclusion. They decided. It was social contract among the sages. We don't disagree with the earlier generation. So writes the Kesef Mishnah. Rav Elchanan Wasserman quotes the same position from Rav Chaim Brisker. They could disagree, but they don't. Very odd idea. I'm not exactly clear what that means. By the way, when I said to argue regarding the Gzera Shava has to exist by tradition. I didn't mean arguing logic, but arguing I have this Gzera Shava or I have a different Gzera Shava. That's what I'm talking about there. But what is he talking about? So one idea, and this is now the second position, is the position taken by the Chazon Ish, and I brought it for you in source number 10. The Chazon Ish writes, Aval ha'emet bazeh, says the truth is, Shador la'achar ha-mishnah ro es miut halavavos neged balei ha-mishnah. That the next generation saw that their hearts literally were reduced compared to those of the authors of the Mishnah. Meaning, they saw that they weren't on the same level. They didn't know as much as the earlier generation knew, or they didn't have the same wisdom and insight that the earlier generation had. They knew, with confidence they knew, that truth would always go with the earlier generation. They said, we can't disagree. And that's a second approach. But then there's a third approach. And the third approach is the approach of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. And he says something which I would love to find historical research on. I have not been able to find any research on this yet. But take a look at source number 11. He writes, Kibbutz kol chachme Yisrael oruban v'chol makom sheheim heim beizdin shall call Yisrael me'elei. And he says, if all the sages gather, or the majority, he says, they qualify as the beizdin for the Jewish people as a whole, regarding whom the Torah says you have to go to the judge who is around in your day. So you have to go to them. Chasimas ha-mishnah ha-yagamkin b'kibbutz kol chachme Yisrael oruban. And he says, you know what? When Rebbe concludes the Mishnah, they had a huge siyum. And all the chachamim got together, presumably in Tzipori, and they marked the closing of the Mishnah. Or maybe the majority of them got together. And they therefore had the power of being based in Hagadol, the great based in. And they said, the only way you can disagree with what we've done here in the Mishnah is if you get a based in like this together. Based in shall call Yisrael. But otherwise you can't. So it's not about being as wise or as knowledgeable as your predecessors, but rather it was done by fiat when they closed the Mishnah. Anybody ever hear anything like this before? This idea that when they that the reason why a Tana can't disagree with an Amora can't disagree with a Tana is because when they closed the Mishnah they actually had a convention. There was a convention of the Chachamim, and they declared, you can't disagree. This was new for me, this idea of Rav Elchanan. I would very much like to know who did the seating at the convention. But that's what that's Rav Elchanan's idea. And then last, yeah.
I guess something very similar to that, but that's why we are bound by the Shulchan Aruch as well, that by the time when the Shulchan Aruch was composed, it's a similar idea that from the time, all they seem to have assembled it. All, most of them, at least, seem to endorse the Shulchan Aruch in the final site.
So that's a really interesting point. Because take a look at source number 12. This is where we're headed, although not quite the way that I'm hearing you say it. But Rav Kook has a fourth idea, which is the one that I wanted to zero in on to explain a Ramah. Who, well, you'll see. The Ramah writes in source number 12. Now the Rama is in the Shulchan Aruch. He can't be talking about the Shulchan Aruch. But he says, you should not be lenient on something if the chiburim, the compositions that have spread throughout Israel, are strict. Unless you have a tradition from your rebbeim that indeed you do something different. But he says, there are books out there which have been accepted, and you're not allowed to disagree with them. So Rav Kook read this, and Rav Kook wrote a commentary to Hilchos Dayanin, the laws of judges that are in the Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat. And in there he says, you know, I thought that was a fascinating idea. That not only do rabbis have some kind of authority potentially, but books have some kind of authority. And there are books that have been accepted and books that have not been accepted. Where did the Ramah get this idea from? And Rav Kook says, the Ramah got it from source number 13. In source number 13, we find the position of the Ran, going back about 700 years, not discussing books, but discussing gezeros, discussing rabbinic decrees. And what the Ran does, I'm going to summarize, but you can see it in source number 13, is to identify three categories. He says, if you have a gezera that has spread through all Israel, then no one is able to cancel that position. No one is able to cancel the gezerah, the decree. Even if your Beis Din is greater than theirs, you still can't cancel their decree. It doesn't matter, because it's become popular Jewish practice. Second, if it hasn't spread, but it's a reasonable gezerah, you have to be greater than them to cancel it. And if it hasn't spread, and it's also something the community can't bear, then anybody can come along and cancel it. You just need any Beis Din to cancel it. The point that emerges from the Ran, and the point that Rav Kook seizes upon here, is that popular acceptance is what determines the strength of a gezerah, and he applies it to books as well. In source number 14, he says that's what the Ramah is doing here, and that would go to what you're saying, Adam, regarding the authority of Shulchan Aruch, although not with the convention idea of Rav Elchanan. But what he says is, in source number 14, we're in the home stretch, folks, he says, V'nirin ha-devarim sheb'inyan etzem kviyus ha-halacha. He says, when it comes to establishing law, when it's not a gezerah, when it's not an enactment, a formal enactment of a Beis Din, so you don't invoke the rule of no Beis Din can cancel the words of an earlier Beis Din, you go to the judge in your day. However, he says, if something has been accepted and has spread, that this is what we do, that is like a takana. It is like an enactment. Rav Kook's idea is, basically, Minhag Yisrael. The reason why you don't change the practice is Minhag Yisrael, and perhaps that's what the Kilas Yaakov is saying when he defends us. Let's go full circle now. We started out with Birchas Kohanim at Mincha on a fast day, right? And we said that the Gemara's conclusion is that we duchen at Mincha on a fast day because our Mincha on a fast day is late, and normally during the week we daven early. Our question was, that's not true for us. We don't have a variation between our mincha time on a fast day and mincha time during the week. And potentially, if we do have a variation, it's the opposite. Our mincha is early, not late. So we don't match what they're doing. Do we follow their practice and duchen et mincha? Or do we not follow their practice? We follow their logic and not duchen et mincha. And we said the Chazon Ish preserved the practice in defiance of the logic. He said, we're going to keep on duchening even though the logic doesn't apply. And that was what they did in his base medrash. And the question is, why do that? And Achilles Yaakov noted that that's true in many other areas of halacha, like Kiddush and Shul Friday night outside of Israel. We keep right on doing what was done in the days of the Gemara, even though the logic for which this practice was created doesn't hold sway anymore. And what I'm suggesting is, we saw four reasons why Amoraim don't agree with Tanoim. Either Amoraim simply said, either because the Amoraim simply said, we're not going to disagree with Tanoim, they're in the Mishnah, we're not. Or, possible variation on that, Amoraim recognized they're not on the level of the Tanoim, they can't dispute the positions of the Tanoim. Third possibility, the position of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Rav Elchanan says that there was a gathering of Chachamim and they said, you may not disagree with the position of the Tanoim. And then the last one, the one that's relevant for us, the position taken by Rav Kook, and he ascribes it to the Ran. Rav Sabato also sees it as a position of the Maariz Chiyus, and that is that we go with the practice over the logic, because once the Chachamim created a practice and it became popular, that is now Minhag Yisrael. That's the way Jews do things. And we don't need logic. We're Jews. The original logic doesn't apply. Nonetheless, we are going to continue to do it. It is Minhag Yisrael. Yes?
So what happens if the popular practice goes against what was previously popular?
Well, how did that become?
What if there was a mass idea of, you know, we're gonna ask for rain now in America when we need rain, not when Iraq needs.
Right. So the question would be, how did they get there? In other words, the first one to do it should be told, you can't do that, because now you're violating what the minhag is. You know, before you're able to reach a point where now it's the majority who are doing something different.
But can we now go the other way?
Right. So my understanding is, well, two things. Let's say we're talking about a local minhag, not minhag Yisrael. My understanding is that if there were to be an attempt to do a change of minhagim, hataras nedarim of some kind would be required. You'd have to have a beis din, they'd have to explain why there should be a change and so on, and get the approval of a beis din to do, you know, some kind of a change like that. I'm not sure you can do that with such a public neder. I'm not even sure that hataras nedarim will work in such a circumstance. I haven't looked into it, so I don't know. Yeah.
There are any number of places in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says it's halacha, and the Ramah says we don't do that here in Poland.
Correct, because
that's only I don't know if it's local or European versus Sfaradi, but the Shulchan Aruch says this is the halacha.
Right.
So we just don't follow this halacha.
Right, and that's
So what is Minhag Yisrael then? Not follow the halacha.
So, what you're talking about is a case in which there is no Minhag Yisrael. There is Minhag Ashkenazim, and there is Minhag Sfaradim, and there isn't a Minhag Yisrael to work with.
No.
That's what the Ramah will tell you. He'll say, we're not beholden to this because we, going back to the Maharil, going back to the Trumas Hadeshen, you know, ever since Jews lived in Germany, we did it this way. And the fact that your Sfaradi communities are doing something different because the Rashba said X, it's fine for the Talmidim of the Rashba and his community.
There are places that says we don't do what they did in Germany, in Poland. We hold differently. Because the Germans, in many respects, follow Shulchan Aruch. And says, well,
No, I'm talking about Germany pre-Shulchan Aruch.
No, I know.
So,
There are many places where he takes issue with...
with existing Ashkenazi practice?
Some things that the Ashkenazim do, according to Shulchan Aruch, that they didn't do in Poland.
I'm not sure that... I can't think of a particular case. I'm not saying that there aren't any, but I'd have to see a particular case in order to understand why it would be, you know, why it would be different. If you had a particular one, we could speak to that. There are cases in which the Ramah will say, we follow, let's say, the Rambam. Right? There are cases in which the Ramah says, the law here follows the Rambam, but that's not in dispute with an existing Ashkenazi practice. He's simply saying, this is what we do. Yeah.
When you mentioned the Kiddush and Shul issue, it's my understanding that some shuls and yeshivas don't follow that practice anymore. If you're following Minhag Yisrael as opposed to the logic, what right do you have to say, you know what, that minhag, we don't have to follow that. It doesn't make sense to us.
Right. So this is a really good question. The reason why the Beis Yosef wrote what he did regarding Kiddush and Shul on Shabbos, that which I had brought in source number 9, was because the tour had said we shouldn't be doing Kiddush and Shul. In other words, the Beis Yosef was responding to someone, not just someone, but the tour, who said we shouldn't do Kiddush in Shul Friday night. And the tour, in fact, said our shuls in Eretz Yisrael don't do Kiddush in Shul Friday night. So today, when a minyan is formed and people say, you know, we're gonna do what they're doing in Eretz Yisrael, or we're gonna do what the tour prescribed, and we're not going to do it, ostensibly, they're adopting a different view. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that the position taken by the Chazon Ish, and the position which the Stipler then seeks to defend, is not necessarily the only way to look at things. I'm taking a view that says we should be conservative of the practice against the logic. But it does sound like the tour, And whoever fueled the tour on this issue of Kiddush and Shul Friday night is going to say, we take it a different approach. We are actually saying that, no, you change it. You follow the logic of the Gemara, not the practice of the Gemara. So that would be the answer.
Wait a minute, fit in there. That's what I was thinking. In Ashkenazi communities, Kiddush was made for centuries, and you're in Ashkenaz. How can you change that?
Right. And the answer would have to be that you would have to appeal to the Torah. And that would be the only grounds that I could think of, would be to say, but this has been a halachic discussion all along, and there's been another side, and therefore we're going to go with the other side. I should note, I'm abbreviating, but there's one point I should add. Regarding Kiddush and Shul Friday night specifically, the point is made in response to the Beis Yosef that perhaps when they made Kiddush and Shul Friday night, it wasn't a takana. On the Kiddush case specifically, the argument is made that it wasn't an enactment of, now we're going to start making Kiddush and Shul Friday night. There were guests who showed up. They needed somebody to make Kiddush, so they made Kiddush. The next week, there were guests who showed up. They made Kiddush. There weren't guests some week. They didn't make Kiddush. It became something that we did, but that originally it wasn't done as a takana. It wasn't done as a minhag. My brother's been asking, been waiting very patiently. Yes?
So what gives a rishon or an afros the ability to say something's a minhag toast?
Ah, that is a really good question. I was hoping you wouldn't ask. Leave it to my brother. Tosfos does discuss the idea of a minhag simply being a mistake. And we find that in the Rishonim. And there are some well-known examples of it. If you ever want to see a whole collection of them, Rabbi Daniel Sperber loves to bring them in his Minhagei Yisrael. He brings the classic one. You know about the Algerian Pesach sandwich? He brings in his Minhagei Yisrael, he talks about a community in Algeria in which the minhag was that after davening on the eighth day of Pesach, all the people would gather together, they would bring sandwiches, like chametz sandwiches, they would walk to a certain spot outside of town, and they would all sit down and they would eat their sandwiches on the eighth day of Pesach. Why? So some chacham shows up and learns about this practice and says, what in the world do you think you're doing? And he manages to trace it back to a time when they were visited by a chacham from Eretz Yisrael, who came there, and he was there on Pesach, and on the eighth day of Pesach, he took a sandwich, because he could, and he went outside of town where he thought nobody would see him, and he wouldn't be differing from local practice, but he didn't realize that having a chacham visiting, they wanted to see all his practices, and they trailed him to that spot, and they saw that he did this, and they thought, this is a neat thing to do on the eighth day of Pesach. Bizarre. I can call that minhag toast, pretty easily. But the truth is, it's very difficult. It's not an easy sugya. I'm not confident in trying to provide lines other than to say what is fairly obvious, which is if it conflicts with known established halacha and there's no foundation, to justify it, then I can say it's a minhag toast. But that's easy. There are too many minhagim where you have to ask yourself, for example, throwing breadcrumbs on to the fish at Tashlich. So you can be a firebrand and say, well, you're not supposed to feed them. They're not yours. They don't depend on you for food. Therefore, you shouldn't feed them on Yom Tov. On the other hand, based on various Rishonim, you can find justifications that avoid the halachic problems that are involved. If you do it in certain ways, you can get around that. So do you say... Sorry?
And it's a minhag you throw it. Our father did not go to Tashlich for a shut up. But the vast majority of the shuls did.
In terms of whether it's minhag, I'll tell you the truth of the matter is that about 15, 20 years ago, I polled Jews from Iran and Russia and a couple of European countries. And it's not as much of a minhag Yisrael as we tend to think it is. In Iran, they had no idea. They would shake the corner of their coat. That was what they did. They didn't throw any breadcrumbs or anything. The Russians didn't know of it, but I wasn't sure why, whether that was because of a break in their chain or whether that was really like that they didn't do this. But I've heard it suggested that was basically something invented in New York as a way to amuse the kids when you went to Tashlich. So who knows how that became Minhag Yisrael. But the point is that you have Minhagim which can be justified halachically, but that doesn't necessarily make them halachic minhagim, and maybe the answer is minhag tos. I'm not expert enough to be able to draw lines in that. Yes?
If you're going with the tour, that you're going over logic over practice, then you run into a situation with one day yantif chutz la'aretz.
the let's bring in every single problem. The okay. There, your question is: are you dealing with minhag at all? At that point, you're already you're beyond minhag. That's a discussion. No, because the problem is that's the Rambam and the Chacham Tzvi, the whole discussion about whether we really view it as being minhag or not. Because if it's minhag, then the question is, what if I move to a place outside of Israel where no Jews have ever lived? So there is no minhag. So I can keep, we keep one day.
Obviously embodied in halacha is today.
Yes.
But even so, if you go into the logic versus practice situation, if you go with the logic guys, then you're only going to have one day yantif.
Assuming that you would really view it as being just minhag, which again is not clear cut. I mean, I should mention once we're
minhag doesn't matter. Logic versus practice. Practice has been 2 days yantif in halacha.
No, but we have to go back to square one. We brought in minhag in order to justify going with practice over logic. But the original debate was, when the Gemara states a halacha, and logic dictates that we should change the practice, because the original logic that they brought in the Gemara no longer applies, then the question is, am I going to follow what they did, or am I going to follow what they said? That's really the fundamental question. And if we take the view of following what they said, the reason for doing that may be because we follow minhag, and that became minhag. That's the chain. But I should note, because we're mentioning all these other popular cases, so I'll throw in, yes, the Kilas Yaakov in his discussion does mention Kitnios. He throws that into. But I wanted to get to one last point regarding all of this. And if someone has to go to breakfast, I understand. And that's the question of... Yeah. The question of why minhag is so important. What is it about minhag that we should really be bound by it to the extent where we're going to use that and we're going to justify following practice instead of following logic? So minhag matters, first of all, in terms of building community. I brought you two sources from the realm of sociology, anthropology, in sources 15 and 16. Sociologist Emil Durkheim in 1912 writes, "If religion has given birth to all that is essential in society, it is because the idea of society is the soul of religion." Now, he's obviously not dealing with Torah from Sinai and mitzvos and obligations and so on. But I bring it here to point out that from the perspective of sociology, the society is the soul of religion in the sense that religion builds community. You get a group of people who identify with an idea, who identify with a set of practices. And if you take a look at 16, which Rich Sosis, who I actually know, wrote, he's talking about anthropologists. And he says these authors, the anthropologists, maintain that one of the primary functions of religion is the promotion of group solidarity. They argue that collective rituals enable the expression and reaffirmation of shared beliefs, norms, and values, and are thus essential for maintaining communal stability and group harmony.
Except when it's
Imanag Taos, in which case, yes, we'll throw it out. And if they don't like our community anymore, that's their problem. What they're saying is that ritual keeps people together. It keeps people identifying as a group. And so even if by logic, I should say, don't practice this anymore, you run the risk that if you change the minhagim, people no longer feel like they're members of the same community. And that's very important. You run the risk of splintering the community that has accepted the minhag. Rabbi Zion Uziel made the same point regarding lulav. He talks about the risks that are involved in altering communal minhag. If you take a look at source number 17, he says, "Kol chiluke minhagim betfilos, all the divisions of customs in prayers, maasei ha-mitzvos, the deeds of mitzvos, v'horos chalukos, and various rulings that contradict each other, b'nyanim tziburim, and public matters, shenasim b'pumbi b'beis ha-kneses echad, heim b'chlal azharos labdalosis godedu." He says, if you're going to divide up the way people daven in one shul, if you're going to divide up their mitzvos and say some will do the mitzvah this way, some will do the mitzvah that way, if you're going to divide up and have people following different rulings, he says that's lo sisko to do. You're not allowed to split yourselves, as the drasha on that pasuk goes. V'karav hadavar lomar shezehu begeder mitzvah haba'a ba'aveira. He says that's close to, he's not willing to call it that, but he says it's close to a mitzvah achieved via transgression. Now, he's dealing again with the case of shaking the lulav. And people in a shul who all shake the lulav in different directions. He's in the early state of Israel, and he has a shul in which you have people who have come in from various places, and they all have different ways to shake the lulav. So he says, you're running into losis go to do problems. He says, clearly this is not the ideal way to do it. He says, everything that we do must maintain and make evident the unity of the Jewish people in the service of Hashem. That's what he says. So minhag matters, even at the expense of the logic that the Gemara gave, because in the absence of the minhag, the unity of the nation falls apart. Yeah. Oh boy. I left one out. Putting on tefillin during Chol HaMoed, and the issue of a shul having people doing the same, doing different things. Sorry?
That's a class example.
Right. So indeed, there are many shuls where they won't allow that. Where they will say that you can't have multiple people in the same, you can't have two different minhagim going on in the same minyan, and they'll have different minyanim, or they'll tell people who wear tefillin, daven outside with your tefillin until you take them off, and then you can come back inside. I am aware that that in a certain shul in Oceanside, New York, there is a psak that you can have both multiple. Was it Rav Aaron who said it? Rav Aaron Soloveitchik felt it was not, presumably, and now I'm guessing, because he felt that both are really standard minhag now, and therefore no one is going to have strife, but Rav Uziel's point would still stand. Rav Uziel's point is that we don't look like the same community if we're doing two things that are visibly different. Yes? So I have no idea what's done here. So
here we have both. Here we have both. But I doubt it was in Baltimore on Chol HaMoed Pesach, and in the Aguda in Baltimore, it was interesting. The people with tefillin davened in the shul. The people who were not wearing tefillin davened behind the pizza. And you would expect that since it's a shaped well concept.
Yeah, that's interesting.
We have complete tolerance.
Got it. But you were going to say?
No, I was just going to say, an Ashkenazi Jew cannot walk into a Sephardic shul on Chol HaMoed Sukkot and put tefillin on.
Well,
that's much more clear. I mean, in our heterogeneous, very mixed, Golas communities, there is a lot of competing validity, and so, Rabbi Kelleher is fond of pointing out in these issues, what did your father do, and that's probably numitius in power of minhag, meaning
right.
The Muslim versus the
Minhag. Right, and certainly true. I mean, realistically, what we deal with now is indeed a function of the melting pot where different communities from different places came together, and I shouldn't call it really the melting pot, because on the one hand, some people melted in and just said, I'll do as is there, and some people said, no, we're going to do as our ancestor did in whatever community we came from. But what I would note is, the answer of, we're all okay with this, I'm okay with the fact that I put on tefillin and that you don't, that answer only goes so far. If I assume that the concern of losis godu is strife, then I've solved the problem, there's no strife. But if my concern is that we should appear as one nation before Hashem, as Rav Uziel contends in source number 17, then I haven't solved that problem. Sorry?
That problem will
remain. But I want to make sure to get to the last source in Rav Hai Gaon. because the Vahaya Gaon is much stronger in the reason why Minhag is important. What we've said until now is that Minhag is important because it keeps people together, keeps people as one community, whether psychologically or aesthetically. But if you take a look at source number 18, Vahaya Gaon says you can't have halacha without Minhag because all of halacha exists only due to Minhag. And this is what he says. Minayin anu yodin, ki yesh aleinu mitzvah litkawa biyom zeh. He says, how do we know that we have a mitzvah of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah? V'ikra Torah k'suva, minayin anu yodin ki hi taras Moshe shekasva mipi ha'gevura. He says, the Torah that we have, how do we know that that's Moshe's Torah? How do we know that that's the Torah that was given to us at our Sinai? Ela mipi am Yisrael. It's only because the Jewish people say so. Hine, elu ha-me'idim aleha gam he-me'idim ki b'masa yatsanu yedecha v'aseinu. He says, the same people who tell you this is the Torah are the ones who tell you our obligation is to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. V'chikein ha-tiku b'kabbala y'pi ha-nevi'im halacha l'moshim y'sinai. And that's what the prophet said, and that's what we've been doing all the way since Sinai. V'divrei ha-rabim hu ha-mochiach al-kol mishnah v'al-kol gemara. He says, it's the words of the community that testify to the validity of every mishnah and of every gemara. Right, the highest proof that we can have is go out and see what people do. He says the essence is go see what people do, and only after we know what people do, do we say, okay, go read the Mishnah, go read the Gemara. And whatever emerges from the Mishnah, from the Gemara, and whatever answers we can give to justify or to explain, good. He says, and if there's something there in the Gemara that doesn't fit, that we can't clarify, that we can't jive with what we do, it doesn't uproot what Bnei Yisrael do, which Rav Chaim Gaon identifies as the Ikar. Rav Chaim Gaon is saying, the authority of Minhag is the authority of Torah itself. And so, in the event, to go back and fully close what we've been saying. In the event that the Gemara says, do X because of this reason, even where the reason says to me, don't do X, nonetheless, I'm going to say, because this is what Jews have done, this is what I will continue to do. Now again, this is not a universal point of view. You could make the argument within halacha and find halachic sources that say, no, we disagree. And the Chazon Ish himself, when he wrote about the issue of Birchas Kohen, about Mincha on a fast day, he wrote Sarach Iyun. That was his closing words. He said, this requires examination. And the only reason we know what he did is because the Stipler came along and said, yeah, but he continued to duchen. That the Chazon Ish, in fact, had duchening in his base medrash on the fast day. So we know that there is an alternative point of view out there. But within this approach of conservatism, of saying we're going to conserve the practice at the expense of the logic, I believe that the answer for why is because of this authority of Minhag. Yes?
I recognize that in recent times we've become in many ways more machmir in many of our observances. How about that? How does the ability to say, well, what we did before was not acceptable, even though the road followed that, now we have a higher standard of kashrus or klat or any area of Judaism we want to talk about where we have more chumras than we had or maybe our parents' generation did? Is it to say that they just didn't do it properly? Or that minhag or the way they observed was not at an appropriate level, but we know better?
Right. So my understanding is that chumra requires justification. Meaning, let's say, for example, that I decide that my broccoli is infested with bugs, and therefore I won't eat it unless I check it and I have to check it in this way. And I tell my kids, this is what we're going to do. And someone says, well, you know, your grandparents didn't check broccoli in this way. So now I have to find out, why didn't they check it in that way? Was it because they held one way and I hold another way? Or is it because they didn't eat broccoli? Or is it because their broccoli was grown with pesticides and therefore they didn't have infestation? You know, there has to be a justification for a chumrah. Maybe a chumrah comes about for a different reason. The Chasam Sofer talked about the importance of creativity in halacha and the importance of adding practices. The Chasam Sofer was very into originality. He said, if you just have the Shulchan Aruch, you don't have anything at all. The idea would there is not necessarily that I'm going to change what was done because I have a halachic concern, but because I want to personalize things. And this is something that's important to me. So let's say I decide, I'm making something up now, let's say I decide that Friday night, after I finish eating dinner, I am going to sit down and learn, I don't know, a siman of Shulchan Aruch. That's going to be my practice because I want to take on something special. Right? Or let's say I decide that because Erevin, this is another popular one, because Erevin consistently rely on various leniencies, therefore I'm not going to use the Erev. Even though it fits within halacha, and there's a posek who says it's okay, nonetheless, because every Erev relies on kulos, which is true, for me personally, I am going to insist on doing something extra, because it has meaning to me. That would be a justification for somebody to take something on personally. It would not be a justification for him to then tell other people, you have to take this on as well. But as I understand it, Chumrah requires justification. The Prima Gadim writes in his introduction on Klalei Hapsak, on how you paskin. So he writes, you're not allowed to simply say, I'm going to be machmir for people because I'm not sure. Because every Chumrah leads to a kula. You're going to be strict on one thing. In the end, you're going to end up being lenient on something else, directly or indirectly, as a result of the chumrah. We don't approve of just random chumrahs. But if there's a logic to it, such as a situation has changed and therefore necessitates a change in practice, or I personally, you know, this resonates with me and is going to help me get closer to Hashem, so a person can, as an individual, say, I'm going to take this on. I would be very careful about trying to do that in a community. I think that's a very difficult thing to sustain. Yes?
Why is it no...